This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to a brand new edition of Freedom Books, Flowers and the Moon, the podcast brought to you each week by the Times Literary Supplement. My name is Stig Abel and I am the editor of the TLS. Here is my food-loving friend, well, colleague, Thea Leonarduzzi. Thea, hello.
Hello, I was going to do some mock offence taking, but I can't be bothered.
I thought we could do your favourite foods in this beginning, because okay. I think we always talk about food.
Right.
And I thought we could, over the course of the next few weeks, learn more about your tastes.
Okay.
Favourite crisps?
Yeah. I'm not really into crisps.
I knew you wouldn't.
Except for I do really like the San Carlo ones.
Oh.
Just so that's on
brand.
Are they Italian? Yeah, they're particularly thin.
Are crisps part of Italian food culture?
Yeah, with a glass of something.
Yeah.
Well, because, you know, it's the law in Italy that if you're having a drink before, I think it's 8 p.m, you have to be given some little stuzzichini, like nibbles, so crisps or pretzels or nuts, or some places, it becomes a competitive thing. So from bar to bar, each one is trying to outdo its competitor, and so you'll have these lovely platters of bruschette and salumi.
So it's a bit like tapas but free. It's free sometimes in Spain, I think, isn't it? If you buy a drink, you get tapas. But in Spain, it's illegal. In Italy, you have to...
Mm. That certainly used to be the case.
Really?
Yeah.
I love finding this sort of stuff out. your favourite biscuit?
Favourite biscuit, again, it depends. Is it a sort of an everyday biscuit or a special biscuit?
Impose your own constraint.
Okay, well, everyday biscuit, I'll go with the milk chocolate digestive.
Very good.
My nonno used to work in the McVitie's factory on the production line.
Oh, so amazing. Did you get them free?
Loyalty there. No, this was before my time. This is when he was in England.
Yeah.
Before he went back to Italy. And as a special occasion biscuit, Grasmere gingerbread.
Yeah. I think we could do this every week. I'll pick another.
Counter with your own?
Well, my favourite crisps. See, I'm going to yet again show my plebeian tastes here, aren't I?
Skips.
I did like. Do you know what? I like McCoy's.
What's it?
McCoy's.
McCoy's.
Salt and vinegar.
Okay, that's all right. That's classic. That's solid.
And then my favourite biscuit. I like anything chocolatey.
You say that with a smile.
Yeah, just. I love a chocolate biscuit. Like the thicker, a thick chocolate. I mean, I'll go with milk chocolate digestives as well.
It's a classic.
Yeah, we can't.
As an everyday biscuit, it's difficult to fault.
Yeah, exactly. All right, there's a whole podcast in here, but we won't do that. But I will try and come up with other areas to ask you about. Also, I feel we get a bit of a tour of Italian culture.
You never know, we might end up friends by the end of it.
Yeah, indeed. People do bond over food, don't they? Anyway, enough of that. Here's the bit where I encourage you to subscribe to the TLS, not Thea, you, the listener. Use this special offer code, the-tls.co.uk/podcast offer. That's podcast offer. The best price anywhere on the internet, 5 issues for £5 or $5. Coming up this week, one of the least satirical things you can say about modern politics is that it has made satire impossible, what with everything being so ridiculous and awful. Well, we asked the satirist Madeleine Brettingham just how hard it is to be funny about today's political culture. Samuel Beckett was one of the most mordant observers of the ridiculousness of the human condition. A new version of Endgame is on at the moment, and TLS editor Toby Lichtig can tell us whether it's worth waiting for. And you've heard us talk about Aleppo on this show enough. What actually is it? Thea will attempt to introduce the subject without using the letter O, although she won't. So, is it the best of times or the worst of times to be a satirist? A good question asked and answered this week by Madeline Brettingham, who should know as she's a writer for the News Quiz on Radio 4. She likens being a comedy writer to feeling a bit like a dog trying to chase six tennis balls without dropping the one in its mouth, which sounds fun but exhausting. Madeline has also found time to read two books that touch on the subject: Stuart Lee's March of the Lemmings, Brexit in Print and Performance, 2016-19, and an essay collection called The Joke is on Us, Political Comedy in Late Neoliberal Times. She really should have the answer. Madeline's in the studio with us now. Madeline, hello.
Hello, I hope I do.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. Now, before we talk about the books, because they're both interesting, it's a cliche, isn't it, this idea that satire is difficult now. Is it true?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really interesting question. I've kind of been obviously thinking about it a bit, writing this article. I think the kind of answer is yes, up to a point. I mean, I guess it's always been... Satire, I guess, I think of as like justified mockery. So there's always a debate about, is this satire? Have I got the right target? Am I punching up? Is what I'm saying, you know, sort of proportionate? But I think it has got, harder.
Do you think people
recently.
Think like that?
Yeah, I do.
Do satirists worry about punching down? And
I think people take it much more seriously than you might think. Yeah, yeah. I do. I think.
And you make this point that everyone's a satirist now, which has been difficult for. Not your show necessarily, but I was thinking of a show like Have I Got News For You, that weekly show where a lot of the best gags about something, a lot of the best satirical takes can happen instantly on social media. So is the pressure higher on the satirist to come up with news stuff?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. The market is so crowded now. There's much more pressure on you to come up with something original and novel. That's got a lot harder because of Twitter, and obviously not everybody using Twitter is being paid to write satire, but there's that attention economy where you can get loads of retweets and a massive buzz from thinking up a good joke about the news. Yeah. So your average kind of punter in the street has got more of an incentive to come up with the one line than before you do. So I think it does really add to the pressure.
And has that made it harder for you, do you feel, in your job writing for the News Quiz?
I think it makes it sort of harder but a bit more interesting, because I think it really helps you to kind of drill down into, number one, what's the voice of the show? What's this host and this show got to say about this story that nobody else can? And it kind of makes you drill down into what do I feel about this story? Like zoning out from all the chatter around me. What do I think is the right angle? What do I think is the most important thing? And like, what can I bring... what kind of observations can I bring to this that nobody else can? And that can be quite interesting.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what really good satire does, is you get not just an insight into the issue, but you get an insight into the satirist as well.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I'm trying to work out how to ask this without sounding really damp, but has it changed damp?
What does damp mean?
Well, listen, hold
okay.
on. So has it changed in terms of the climate, the audience's mood? Thinking in terms of us becoming, you know, everyone's always saying, increasingly polarised, does it become harder to laugh without worrying about this is exactly what they think we'll be laughing at, the others, you know, the them and the us?
Ah, right, okay.
Is there a smugness, you know, sometimes?
Yeah. Well, I think, like, part of that is that there's just so much more feedback now if you're producing satire. So, you know, you'll get it. You used to get people writing in, but now you'll get people on Twitter kind of atting the show and saying what they think, and you'll get it from the left, you'll get it from the right, you'll get it from all parts of the political spectrum. So you kind of know whatever you write, whatever you perform, is going to get criticised by somebody. And I think that can have a bit of a paralysing effect sometimes. The second thing you were saying about sort of the idea of like playing into people's hands,
yeah,
I think that's also a concern. But then there's a sort of good side to all of this, because it means it can be an incentive not to be lazy, I suppose.
But in an ideal world, you want to write a gag that whatever your political beliefs, both sides will find it funny.
Yeah, because I think the guys who wrote Yes Minister said this, but satire is about the seven deadly sins, really. The stuff that it's mocking, everybody should be able to point out and say, yeah, this is wrong, this is laughable. So you are kind of aiming for something that's a bit universal, I think.
Yeah, but that's not the knock on it, is it? Because the knock from often angry right-wing people is that satire is particularly and comedy generally is particularly that there's like that one right wing inverted commas comedian who seems to pop up everywhere as the right wing comedian, Jeff Northcote.
Yeah,
and I'm not criticizing him, but he's like seen as the right wing comedian because everyone else is seen as sort of liberal left.
Yeah.
Is that true, do you think, or does it matter, or is it just people looking for things to get angry about the BBC about, which is a common problem of the age as well?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one, because I think it's just the way it's kind of panned out, and I don't know why that is. I guess people who are drawn to satire and mockery are maybe people who feel like, for whatever reason, they're not part of the establishment. Yeah. Maybe that's been the case. So there's a tendency to be left wing there. But you do have, you know, people on in writers' rooms that, and people on panel. You know, there's Simon Evans does a news quiz quite a lot. There's and Jeff as well. I think you do have right wing voices in those.
Is there
places.
A consensus in a writers' room? Do you ever feel that way? You actually do you have to say, guys, we all believe the same thing here. Do you ever feel that there's a consensus in a writers' room?
You will often. In that sort of situation, because I think comedy writers are people who slightly dislike consensus,
yeah.
So you'll often get someone who kind of wade in and be devil's advocate or just sort of go, or the producer might do it, particularly on a satire show like the News Quiz. The producer might come in and say, all right, OK, well, we're all looking at it from this angle, but have you considered? Or I know that I'm going to get letters in from people saying X, Y, Z,
yeah.
So what do you think about that? So you sort of try and sort of mix it up, but yeah.
Are satirists generally embittered show-offs writing to tight deadlines?
Well, I incriminated myself.
Yeah, I know. I thought that was a fair line to quote back at you, because you are a satirist yourself.
Well, I did say that good satire should reveal something about yourself, just done it. I mean...
You would die in a writer's room without being that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think really there's something about satire where you're kind of like flicking pellets at the teacher from the back of the classroom. Particularly if you're a writer, you're not on the stage saying these things, but you're getting them said by yeah. somebody. So it's kind of like an extreme, a professional form of passive aggression in a way, or sort of teasing. So I think satire tends to appeal to people, or has been used by people whose only available weapon is insult. So I guess if you had another means of, if you felt you had something else open to you, go for that. It's a way yeah. of kind of, it's a protest, isn't it? So
yeah.
it's
you use the word weapon there,
yeah.
And that's something that quite often is brought to satire. You know, is it futile if it's not actually enacting change? For that's I mean, how would you respond to that?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So I thought a lot about that when I was reading The Joke Is On Us, so the book of essays, because that there's a sense of like the futility of satire, I'd say, something that sort of comes up a lot there. And the way, I guess what I'd say to you, does satire work is, how would you know? There's got to be sort of an alternate history where it doesn't exist. I think jokes or sketches don't tend to bring down governments, but they're part of a cultural conversation that can change things, but slowly, I guess.
I was thinking of you know, Spitting Image in the 80s laughed at everybody, both sides, from what I remember. I mean, I'm sure that's probably true. I'm not definitively aware of it. Yes Minister, and Jonathan Lynn writes for the paper, he wrote Yes Minister, and he was from the left and his writing partner was from the right, but they were equal opportunities. They were going at the political and the civil service class generally, so it's why it's lasted. That's a risk, isn't it, now, that if it's Trump can say there's a certain type of people who will always laugh at me, and therefore I am a victim. And there's this question that theory gets, does it need to be more even-handed? Does it need to be even-handed to be effective satire?
It's really difficult. I mean, I guess two things I'd say about that is, one is, in a world where Donald Trump exists and is so risible, yeah. it's quite hard to feel... I mean, I think anyone across the political spectrum, unless you were a sort of hardcore Trumpist, would agree that he deserves more mockery than most other political
yeah.
leaders. So it's would you be doing your job if you directed as much mockery at his political opponents as you did at Trump? I don't
yeah.
know. It's a really tricky one.
Because also we have the same problem for the TLS, because I'd love to write to publish a beautiful 3,000-word essay on the virtues of Donald Trump, but I can't think of a single person who'd be able to write a beautiful essay who would argue for the virtues of Donald Trump. You might get
but
people
then you're
who
turning
say
into fiction. I mean,
yeah, but that's the point, though, because you might get people who aren't that, who can see some virtues in it, but it feels to me very few people are going to say about Donald Trump, he is a positive force.
And yeah, and ultimately, I think as a satirist, you've got to feel there's some truth in what you're saying.
Yeah.
I mean, even if you're doing it for money, I mean, you've still got to feel, in order to do it well, you've got to feel like you're really sticking the knife into someone who deserves it.
Which brings us to Stuart Lee. Self-consciously collecting his own writing about how he thinks of things to write about and then writing about them.
Yeah.
I kind of love Stuart Lee, but is this too much irony in one place? Is it?
I really enjoy the book, and I guess because I kind of really sympathise with him in some ways, because I suppose he raises a lot of the same issues as in The Joke Is On Us about what it's like to be someone writing satire for money.
Yeah.
And obviously he's sort of sending himself up as part of that, as part of the book. But he does that really well. And probably, I guess that's the sort of... The book, I guess, is a satire of the satire industry of the poster writing it. And I can see why if that's not your thing, you might go, well, no, that's a bit too... Yeah.
But that's true, of his stand-up as well, isn't it?
That yeah.
When it's done perfectly, when it's brilliant, I think at his best, he's probably better than anyone else.
Yeah.
But when he's not 1,000% at his best, it can feel a bit navel-gazing.
I think there's something about, because in the book there's the columns and then there's the stand-up set as well. And the stand-up set, even transcribed, is just like killer from start to finish. And I think there's maybe, he's worked on that character of the stand-up persona of Stuart Lee for longer than he's worked on the character of Stuart Lee, the columnist. So I just wonder if he's sort of, it's just a more developed character.
Are they characters?
I think they're versions of himself, yeah. I guess he's deliberately ambiguous about to what extent.
I always wonder whether that's true when he says, because you write about this, that he talks about, he says, I prefer the stand-up comedian Lee to the columnist Lee. If I and the comedian Lee were to meet the columnist Lee, I think we would beat him up and leave him in a ditch with his glasses smashed. Which is a joke anyway in itself, and yeah. he's being ironic even as he says that. But, you know, Ricky Gervais always says there's a persona, stage persona. But every time I've seen Ricky Gervais interviewed, it's the same persona as he is on stage. And is Stuart Lee that different? I mean, is it an easy thing to say? So, because he wants to give himself light. I mean, a satirist maybe needs license to say the unsayable.
Yes, yeah.
And so you kind of have, and you get away with it by putting it in someone else's mouth.
Yes.
And he writes for himself.
Don't give the game away.
Yeah. But he for himself has to do it in his own mouth. And therefore he has to maybe pretend this character exists to give him the freedom to say something.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of thing, certainly in the, like, collected columns, and you can see that in a lot of the comments he gets below the line, where people get very frustrated because they're like, but where are you in this? You know, what do you care about? What are you really saying about Brexit? What's at stake for you, kind of thing, which I can sort of get. And somehow in the stand-up, there's just more of a sense of him as a real person, yeah. which is perhaps what makes it easier to engage with as an audience or a reader. But I think whether you find it sort of really fun and witty or tiresome, I guess it's a matter of taste, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Yeah. Yeah.
And does it create, do you feel a sort of a sense of detachment when you're watching or reading the news and you're looking at it as potential material? Does it create a kind of detachment, or does it make you experience the news differently somehow?
Well, that's a good one, because I think something I've really noticed over the last few years is people who write or perform satire for a living saying, I'm taking breaks from the news. So even people for whom yeah. that's their job are saying, I just need a break from this. But one of the things that they bring up in The Joke Is On Us, and my favourite, I think, part of the book were the observations about the sort of market forces on satirists to engage with the news in a particular way, and the fact that you're constantly on the lookout for things that are sort of both ridiculous and apocalyptically awful, you know, and how that can kind of lead you to present things in an exaggeratedly sort of negative way. So I think it does kind of change the way you engage with the news.
Is there something, when you listen to a story, say the coronavirus, that's right for making jokes about.
Mm.
Is it right for making jokes about when 10 people in Britain have died, or 1,000 people in China have died, or when it gets to 10,000, when it gets to 100,000, when it gets to 1,000,000? Do you have to think like that? Or actually, to do your job, do you have to think, you know what, my job is to make jokes that I'm comfortable with, but jokes about anything?
Well, yeah, I mean, you absolutely have to think like that, because if you go in, you know, for example, if on the news quiz you were to write 10 jokes about a story in which people, and the audience just sat there in complete silence, you've got to kind of really, really judge it quite carefully. And that can be about all kinds of kind of random things, both, you know, how dark or tragic the story is, but also how close to home it is. If there's a target, so if there's a sort of systemic or government failure where you can direct all the jokes at and maybe ignore the sort of, not ignore it, but not make light of the kind of human tragedy. So there, you have to kind of handle them in a really delicate way. And I think it's really varies from story to story, and just needs this kind of sense of smell almost about what the audience are going to accept.
Yeah.
There's no sort of recipe for doing it. And sometimes you'll be surprised by what you can get away with, and other times you'll get an ooh when you're not expecting it.
Is the audience a good judge of that, though? I mean, because there's an ethical question beyond that, that say the audience laughs at something that's pretty awful.
Yeah.
Does that laugh wipe everything clean? I mean, is the audience the arbiter, or is there a higher standard that you'd have to hold yourself to?
I think it's just got to be your conscience.
Yeah.
sad as it is to say, it's kind of that's what you've got to do. You've got to kind of think, can I justify this to myself?
Yeah.
And then the audience is a good barometer as well.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes the audience will let you know that you've slipped up, or sometimes you'll think, I didn't like that laugh, you know, and it's kind of a mixture of the two things.
I think you're, in your final paragraph, you have the phrase, a moment of satire is a moment of shared moral clarity, which kind of seems to sum it up, and it almost suggests like a moment of quiet after the laughter where you know that there's some kind of higher truth there.
Yeah, because I think that's what's amazing. I mean, satire is really just taking the mickey. And I think in life, that's what's amazing about taking the mickey. You see something you don't think is right. You think, is anyone else thinking this? You think, I'm just going to have a little dig. Other people laugh. You're like, great, other people agree with me. And then there's sort of a consensus has been established. And there's a really wonderful book called Hammer and Tickle, which is about, I think by Ben Lewis, was out a few years ago, about jokes under Stalin's communism. And about how, even though they obviously like didn't overthrow the government, they just kept alive this sense of, guys, like, this is wrong, this isn't right, is anybody else noticing this, in a way that people were allowed to communicate without fear of, you know, getting sort of dobbed in. So I think it is quite powerful, even if it's just in a sort of small way.
That's a great place to leave it. Yeah, lovely moment of shared moral clarity. Madeline Bressingham, thank you so much.
Thanks very much.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you Google Endgame, as I did last week, the whole first page of results takes you via the Marvel Cinematic Universe to Avengers Endgame. But there is another cultural milestone connoted by that title, and one that's a little bit tonally different. The weird, creepy, brilliant play by Samuel Beckett about a master and a servant, and the latter's two old parents who have no legs and live in dustbins. So pretty normal Beckettian stuff then. The latest production at the Old Vic does have the flavour of Hollywood about it. Clove and Ham are played by the big stars Daniel Radcliffe and Alan Cumming, with the existential bin dwellers played by Carl Johnson and Jane Horrocks. Our fiction editor Toby Lichtig went for a jolly evening out in the theatre and joins us now. Toby.
Hello.
Is it a jolly night out?
It was pretty jolly.
Is it?
I had a few disappointments with it, but actually the lack of jolliness was not necessarily the problem. And I do think something about Beckett is that his humour really stands up.
Are there gags?
There are gags. I mean, there's a lot of physical comedy. He was massively into physical comedy. You know, he was a big fan of Buster Keaton. So there are a lot of physical gags. There are fun, you know, word plays. And the whole setup, I mean, you know, the whole, you know, Beckett's world, it's, you know, it's on the verge of total calamity at all times. It's incredibly grim, but there are these shards of light amongst the grimness, and that's how he works.
Nothing is funnier than unhappiness,
exactly, which Beckett himself said is the most important line in the play. And I do think it's no mean feat 70 years on to actually make audiences laugh. I mean, you know, you've just been talking about satire, and satire is something with a very short shelf life in many ways, but his comedy does stand up.
Let's talk about how that does happen, because the thing about Beckett is he's not out of copyright. His estate is very, very active on his behalf.
Oh, yes.
And they basically say Beckett set down how to stage these plays and that's it.
Yep.
Does that mean if I go and see Endgame here, I go and see Endgame in New York, if I go and see it in South Africa.
Years ago, yeah, see it in 10 years' time.
Is it fundamentally the same play?
In many ways, yes. I mean, obviously, there are actors, and actors can do different things, and they have different ranges and different abilities to interpret. And no matter how maniacal the estate is, they can't stop actors acting in their own way. And there are directors who can marshal the actors, and there are various other mechanisms that you can use. But in terms of staging, and in terms of general artistic interpretation, director's hands are pretty much tied.
So what does that go down to the point of...
So I mean, exactly how many windows you're allowed on the set, where they are, how bare the sets, you know, are supposed to be, generally very bare. And it means that they do feel quite stuck in time. And Beckett himself was incredibly controlling. I mean, he didn't really trust actors and he didn't really trust directors. And he was incredibly controlling about his productions.
Yeah.
And ended up directing quite a few of them himself. There was a production of Endgame in New York in the early 80s that deviated in various tiny ways, which he sort of said was completely unacceptable. He didn't even like curtain calls. He said a curtain call after Endgame was an abomination. Anyway.
Lighten up.
Well, yes, arguably.
Yeah, it's not just a play. I mean, but, it's a very good play. But
actually, the problem is it's almost the opposite. Because director's hands are tied, I've said that they're still funny and Endgame is still funny, but actually the emotional impact has gone in many ways. And it's not a question of lighten up, it's a question of actually move us, disturb us. Because when these plays came out in the 50s and early 60s, they were really quite troubling.
Yeah.
But now they feel quite stuck in that kind of sort of 50s existentialism.
So it's a Cold War, everyone's about to be blown up.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, the point I try and make in my piece is, I mean, you know, this is just a very, very obvious point. Endgame, it's on the cusp of end times. It's called Endgame. And it's so ripe for restaging rethinking of the play of the current era, the Anthropocene era. You know, there's various references to things being in short supply, humanity on the cusp. Soon there's not going to be anyone left. There's even stuff about how the weather's changed. And I'm not saying you have to kind of make it incredibly obvious and, you know, have a big beating sun in the middle of the stage, but there are subtle ways of making it more about our world. And I think if directors were allowed to do that more, and that's just one example, I mean, you know, I'm not a director, there are millions of different ways of making this more more impactful today. I think it would just be so much of a better testament to Beckett himself. I mean, I know it was him who stipulated all these incredibly strict rules.
So you couldn't have two women playing?
Well, so there was a famous case about 10 or 15 years ago when, I can't remember where it was, which country it was, but someone tried to put on an all-female production of Godot,
yeah,
and the estate tried to close it down. And in the end, there was a legal battle and they lost because of human rights laws, yeah, which superseded their own desire. But I mean, yeah, if it's down to Beckett, it would be this, you know, it would all men, apart from his female characters, you know, there's the old mother in Endgame, but you know, people of a certain age, very little creative interpretation. There is a reason why we still like going to see Shakespeare 400 years on, and it's because we can do different things with it, which is not to say you can never stage Shakespeare traditionally.
Yeah.
It's not to say you can never do it with Beckett.
It's an impossible thing. It's pure speculation, but you can't help but think, had he survived, it might not have been quite so restrictive.
Possibly not.
Because, I mean, just one thing, you know, he's a playwright for whom language was such an important thing, and language is...
Exactly.
Ever-changing,
exactly,
as we all know.
Language evolves, and there's quite a good example of this in Endgame. So you've got Alan Cumming, who's playing the main character, Ham, who's this slightly malevolent, malign, but nonetheless vaguely sympathetic presence, stuck in his chair, blind, immobile, cantankerous. And one of his early phrases is, I feel a little queer. You know, he's not feeling well, but he's really camping it up, Alan Cumming, does it very well, and he really draws out that queer, and he makes it very camp in a way that it wasn't originally intended in the 1950s, or certainly wasn't to that extent. And so, yeah, you can do stuff with the language still, but it does seem a great shame. And actually Beckett himself was probably a little bit more flexible than his estate is now. There was an example, someone tried to put an Endgame, I can't remember where it was again, and they strung barbed wire around the stage, and they were already in rehearsals, and he found out and he was really furious, but in the end he let it go because he was essentially quite a kind man in many ways, and he didn't want to screw up the actors. You know, he didn't want to get them out of their jobs. You know, the production was already, you know, already in full swing, and he just thought, you know what, let's just leave it because I don't want to cause too much hassle for these people. And in a way, I think maybe the desire to be so faithful to his legacy has kind of, yeah, been counterproductive.
You can't interpret it in the same way. Obviously, the Samuel Beckett, had he survived, he would have, I imagine, you know, gone forth on a kind of case by case way, interpreting, deciding, seeing whether there's sympathies and all that sort of stuff, whereas for an estate they just have to manage it by being black and white, yes and no,
yeah,
about
exactly
stuff.
Exactly.
Would he have liked the Hollywood actors, do you think? Because so these are big names. This is a big draw.
Yes, yeah,
so Beckett and coming and Daniel Radcliffe and Harry Potter.
Yeah, Harry Potter does Beckett.
Yeah. So yeah, exactly. I mean, that's presumably a good thing in terms of it'll get people through the door.
It's a good thing in terms of it'll get through the people. Daniel Radcliffe's a very gifted actor, and actually he plays the part of a Ham's servant, Clove, and he's meant to be this incredibly world weary, wizened, browbeaten character. He looks incredibly fresh faced still. I mean, I know
he
still looks like Harry Potter. It's not really his fault, and they haven't tried to age him, which is probably a good thing. And actually, in the beginning, he does very well because there's a lot of physical theatre. I mean, the first sort of Endgame began life as a mime. It was originally written as a mime, and in the first few minutes, all that happens is that Clove goes up and down the stage, gets up a ladder, opens a window, gets down the ladder, forgets his ladder, has to come back, he's got a limp. And actually Daniel Radcliffe does that very well, and he brings this kind of weird manic energy to it, which works really well. But as the play progresses, he just seems a bit fresh-faced, really. I don't think it really works. Cumming I liked more. I thought he was quite engaging, and there was a sort of certain the campness, this kind of impishness. He kind of encouraged our complicity in quite a good way.
And what about the parents?
The parents, yeah, I mean...
Are they good? Is that a good role?
Yeah, they are quite good roles. I mean, they're relatively minor in the play. They're really important in terms of dramatic foil, but they don't actually appear in the play for that long. So these two, you know, Ham himself is quite decrepit. They're these two even more decrepit parents who live in these bins, and they pop up and they, you know, sort of pathetically and pathetically try to communicate and try to kiss, and one of them saves the other a biscuit. And it is genuinely funny. Maybe I'm not making it sound very funny, but it is genuinely funny. Jane Horrocks is Nell, who's the mum. The prosthetics have gone a bit wrong with her, and she's got this incredibly sort of taut face, which I think is meant to make her look very old. It just looks a bit like she's had a facelift. She didn't work so well for me. The character playing, the actor playing Ham, I thought did very well, and Carl Johnson, and he's got some really good lines in it, and he was kind of a good mixture of sort of barbed and pathetic.
Because it's kind of a bit of a, not quite a rite of passage, but it's a thing that I suppose actors like to do, a bit of Beckett.
Absolutely.
We once ran a review, which I'm going to quote from you now, which I've just found. Do you remember when Ian McKellen did Godot with Patrick Stewart?
Yeah.
Everyone in London rolled over for it.
Yeah.
Eric Griffiths, who is now sadly deceased, who nearly taught me Beckett, and thankfully I said no, because it would just have been impossible, because he knows too much about it. Anyway, he reviewed it for the TLS. And this is what he said, which I think, I wonder how true this would be for this production, you have to say, Toby. Both audience and cast are feigning interest, like minor royalty asking the staff of a municipal swimming pool they've just opened but will never use. Do you get through a lot of chlorine?
That's very good.
The idea being that you're kind of... You're sort of showing off that, oh, it's Beckett and that's all it takes. Do people really invest in this?
I think they do. And I think there is a kind of spectacle element that there possibly shouldn't be. I mean, that's not why I want to go and see Beckett. I genuinely do find him funny and disturbing when done well. And I like that combination of funny and disturbing.
Sure.
But I think it's really sad that people feel that way about it as well. Because I once reviewed, it was a stage version of What? For the TLS many moons ago, and it was for the website, and we had left the comments on. And someone...
Always a mistake.
Yeah, someone left a comment very much to that effect, Stig, of, oh, you couldn't possibly enjoy this, you're just pretending.
Yeah.
And I could not get my head round that, because I had loved it. I thought it was hilarious. It was so good.
I mean, I'd probably say...
It does seem to bring this charge.
Yeah, it does. And I think, you know, it's not to everyone's taste, and that's fine. I mean, I would say Endgame's probably my least favourite of his four major plays, and I've seen Happy Days about three times, and I've loved it each time I've seen it.
It's
in different
the same
ways.
Play, of course.
Yeah, always,
little minor adjustments. Yeah. But yeah, you know, you've got Happy Days, you've got Endgame, Waiting for Godot, and Crap's Last Tape, which is a sort of more minor one, but that's also totally fantastic.
Which actually was the curtain raiser for Endgame originally, Crap's Last Tape.
No, I think there was a tiny short called Act Without Words originally, but maybe it was for the English version.
Yeah.
And there's another. I mean, we should say this, because this has Endgame's really not long, because in a two-hour play, two-hour Direct to the Theatre, you get another play in this.
You do, yes. So actually, we kick off with a different play. Rough for Theatre 2, which Beckett completers will be very familiar with, but everyone else might be less so. I've read quite a lot of Beckett, and I think I know quite well, but I was not familiar with this play at all. It's great. I really enjoyed it. Again, it's Alan Cumming and Daniel Radcliffe.
It's a bit
Radcliffe.
Vaudeville, is it?
It's just, well, it's... Yeah, a little bit vaudeville, and in fact, actually, the opening kind of music is very, very vaudeville. There's a bit of physical comedy as well, you know, sort of light bulb with a mind of its own that keeps on turning off. But basically, the setup is you've got these two death angels who are chatting to each other with this man above them, suspended in a light box, about to jump, and they're kind of deciding whether they ought to intervene, whether he deserves to live or die. Very Beckettian setup. It's funny. There's a lot of wordplay. It's quite camp. I mean, the actual scripting is quite camp. It's quite homoerotic. And it doesn't really make too many demands on us emotionally.
Why do it? Why have it with? Why pair it? Why bother?
Well, actually, I mean, it's a good question. I suppose as a little, you know, Endgame is quite short, so as a little, you know, sorbet to kind of whet people's appetite and give them their money's worth. Yeah. It's actually a good play. I mean, it's a good. I like dramatic shorts. I think it's a form that we don't see enough.
You hardly ever see.
I love going to the theatre and just seeing something for 20 minutes, and then maybe seeing something else as well. I don't just mean I can only bear 20 minutes of theatre, but it's. I think it is. You know,
I'd rather 20 minutes than 3.5 hours.
It was a good save. Yeah. But you know, we like short stories. Why not go to the theatre and see a few shorts? So why stage it? It's good. It also, you know, it doesn't ask too much of us emotionally, and therefore its failure to kind of plunge us into this Beckettian void is fine. It's just it's a nice little short.
So the battle between British and Irish playwrights of the 20th century, many people would say, is Beckett versus Pinter. Pinter's constantly being revived. There is a Pinter Theatre in London.
There is. There's a Beckett Festival.
There's a Beckett Festival.
There's a Beckett Bridge.
Okay. So the competition is raging. I had a conversation on the radio with someone who said they thought Pinter was now the more recognised as a significant figure than Beckett.
Who's more prolific? Oh, I suppose he did a lot more. He did all the screenplay stuff. Yeah, French Lieutenant's Woman.
But there's probably still the same four or five canonical Pinters, aren't there?
It's definitely a competition. That's the thing we all need to remember.
But there can only be one winner.
There can only be one winner, Toby. Who is the winner? And end this debate now.
Okay. Short answer, Beckett, but longer answer. Firstly, Beckett's got the lead on him, hasn't he? You know, he was just around first. And in fact, Pinter was almost a disciple of Beckett's, and Beckett read some of his plays. One of the interesting things about Beckett, though, is, I mean, you were right, he's much less prolific. He wrote his four main plays, none of which is very long, in this sort of 10-year spell between the early 50s and early 60s. We think of him as a playwright, but actually, he spent very little of his life writing plays, and actually, towards the latter end of his life, he got more and more gnomic in his writing. You know, yeah. Page here, poem there.
And I think he said he only wrote plays as a diversion from writing novels.
Yeah, so. But he kind of stopped writing prose in the 50s. Anyway, exactly. Yeah, he started writing Godot as a diversion from writing prose. I did at university and loved them, and I loved Watts.
I read the trilogy,
and I read the trilogy and studied him.
I read the trilogy, but I wouldn't know if. And
More Pricks and Kicks is brilliant.
Yeah, it's excellent.
Would we read, if you sat down and read the trilogy now, would you have the would you have the patience for it?
Pass.
I don't know. Impossible to say.
Well, maybe that's it. Maybe
I wouldn't be reading it for the first time. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah. I genuinely enjoyed it when I read it at the time, but also I was invested in thinking about him in a certain way, writing about him. I think I had a whole few weeks to think about Beckett, so that felt like a. But I don't think I'd enjoy it in the same way as that. I would genuinely happily go and see any of his plays.
The Times asked him to give his thoughts on the year in 1984. Imagine that, you know, sort of random. Have you heard this theory before?
I wish
Beckett had been alive in the era of Twitter.
Oh, well, this is it. And he, here he goes. So, when the Times has his hopes, the hopes for 1984, so it was a kind of they need to fill the arts pages at the end of 1983. And he said this resolution, he said a telegram back, which is great. Resolutions, :0, stop, period. Hopes, :0, stop. Beckett.
Totally brilliant.
He was dead 5 years later.
The thing is, he replied.
Yeah.
He had a sense of humour. Yeah. If he was really that cantankerous, he'd have ignored it. And I think that is Beckett in a nutshell.
And that's what you saw in this. If people go and see this, it's funny.
It is funny. It's just, you know, I wanted to be pulled into that void.
A bit more.
And I wasn't.
All right. Toby Lichtig, thank you very much indeed.
The obvious thing to do when introducing a feature about a group of writers famed for imposing constraints on their creativity would be to impose some kind of constraint on my creative introduction to said venture. But that would be a little obvious, I think. After all, we're talking about the Uli Poor group here, whose motto runs, all that is evident is suspect. And as a subcommittee of the Collège de Pataphysique, pataphysics being a branch of philosophy or science that explores imaginary phenomena that exist on some plane beyond the metaphysical, the last thing that Uli Poor would want is obviousness. Members of the Uli Poor, from Raymond Queneau, who founded the collective, or workshop, in the 1960s, to Daniel Liebenbecker, a modern-day practitioner, are united by a drive for potential literature, a kind of Poundian make-it-new, ramped up to the extreme. I'm going to narrate the same banal anecdote about a man on a bus 99 different ways, said Queneau before producing Exercice de Style. I'm going to write a 300-page novel without using the letter E. That was Georges Perec in 1969 before writing La Disparition. I'm going to completely blow the doors off the stultifying concepts of reader, protagonist and author, said Italo Calvino before writing 1979's novel If on a Winter's Night a Traveller. Why? Because constraint can lead to liberty, or as Perec put it, I give myself rules to be totally free. Apparently farcical stylistic choices can then contain deep, important meanings. Games can be serious. Here in the studio to offer some guidance is Anna Aslanyan. Anna, hello.
Hello.
What triggered the formation of this workshop? What was it a reaction to?
I guess it was just a reaction to, let's say, intellectual zeitgeist. You know, the era was requesting some new forms and new means of expression. Not everyone was not everyone saw eye to eye on that, and not everyone thought that we need to come up with something new. So some of the bits of the academia were seen as quite stale, and a bunch of people in Paris got together. There were scientists, obviously Kuna, who you just mentioned, he was just a writer with some interest in mathematics. And they said, well, that's enough of this old stuff. We need to come up with something new and to explore potential of literature. It was a bit of a secret society. They didn't really mean to kind of teach everyone how to express new ideas in new ways or in any other ways. Little by little, they became more well-known.
Until I came to the TLS, I'm not sure I'd heard of Uli Poor, and I think I'd heard of it. And then when it's used in the TLS, we should say that people in the TLS use it as a... We've used it on this podcast as a kind of a joke.
Times.
The Olympian constraints of something that's not really Olympian. So it's used as a metaphor.
We use it pathetically.
Yeah, we do. Well. But I mean, if 100 people in the street, we said Olympian constraints. How many people now even have heard of it, do you think?
Not that many. When I was working on this piece, I did mention it to a few friends. I mean, some of them were kind of more literary than others, let's say. But the majority would just shrug and say, oh, yeah, that bunch of clever clogs, you know, they are at it again.
Yeah.
Someone who had heard of Uli Poor, and again, it might have been a metaphor for him,
yeah.
Rather than just, rigidly, exactly determined kind of movement. And we may or may not come to that question as well. But anyway, someone said to me, actually, yeah, presumably you're writing it in a constrained kind of way. And what kind of constraints are you going to use? I said, of course, I'm certainly writing it under constraint. My editor wants 2,000 words, yeah. And that's exactly how many words he's going to get.
Yeah.
So any writing is constrained by its nature. I mean, if you're just writing a little shopping list or a treatise or a...
A tweet.
Exactly.
Which is the point we might get
yes.
to. Were you tempted to try and write it without the letter E?
Not this piece, no, because a couple of months earlier I'd written a lipogram. It was La Dispersion, the famous novel by Georges Perec. It was the 50th anniversary of its publication last March. And after that, I just write a little tribute. It was just a shortish piece about its translation into English, brilliantly done by Gilbert Adair in the 80s. It's called Air Void. So like Perec, he doesn't use the letter E in English. So I did it easily, and it was easier than I expected.
Was it easy?
Well, actually, it's quite contagious. You know, you get into it. And
I was going to write the editor's letter as a lipogram without the letters S or A, and then I ran out of time. And then I thought, I can't devote my... Did it take you much longer?
I wouldn't say so, no.
Really? I should have just done it. I got psyched out. I just thought, I can't do this. But...
Did you start and then kind of...
No, I sort of sat down...
There was a lot of talk.
I was talking it up to Thea, and then I sat down, I had a very Olympian short time to write the thing. I thought I can't risk it because I had to do it and then I had to file it. So,
were you talking lipogrammatically, trying to?
I was going to do it lipogrammatically.
Yeah, but when we were talking to
Thea, no, I was just
because that why it would been the secret. That's how Perec actually wrote La Dispersion. I mean, he was holed up somewhere in some writer's retreat, as we probably call it these days. People would come and visit him, and he was working on something. I don't think he announced it as a lipogram, certainly not to everyone, because when it came out, some people didn't realize it didn't have a letter E, funnily enough. But
Imagine being that reviewer who didn't spot that, who reviews a whole review and goes, very good work from Georges Perec, and doesn't notice that.
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about the history of their publication and reviews, but
it is
a slightly apocryphal story that some people missed it. But those who were friends and they came to visit, he'd actually make them speak to him without using the letter E. So he wanted them to collaborate on that.
Get into the mood of it.
Yeah, just get into his stride. And people initially, like you say, oh no, we can't do that. But then the conversation did flow. And,
Thea, do you want to try and ask? Should we try and ask? Can I ask a question? Oh no.
No. Thing is you can't have the constraint imposed on you by someone else. I think you have to.
Really?
It seems important that you should come up with your own constraint.
It is important, but think of translators. Think
That's
of people
true.
Who most of the work that we've got in these books under review possible.
Yeah.
I mean, they follow someone else's constraints.
Yeah.
That's true.
Whether or not they replace them by something kind of equivalent or similar or analogous is a matter for them to decide.
Because the translators of La Disparition had to, was it that they would choose the most common vowel in their
right.
final language?
It's E in English, R also in Italian, in Spanish. I think it's A.
Yeah.
I mean, R, I suppose. The Russian version doesn't have an O.
And in Japan, it wouldn't be a vowel because obviously the alphabet is different.
To be honest, I'm not familiar with. I know that there must be a translation.
Yeah.
I haven't actually looked into.
Because we're talking about the Perec, it seems important to just talk about La Disparition a little bit, just because that is the text that sort of carries. Oulipo for most people. It's the best, probably the best known text, I would say. And that does sort of summarise what it is that Oulipo is. It's games and it's silliness, which we'll come to, but it's also has meaning and it's a device to create something that lasts.
Yes, and also for Perec was a way to talk about something which is missing, which is disappeared. The disappeared, I guess, would be one way to put it in English. And that's his parents who were killed in the war because their letter, which is missing, the French way to pronounce it, is euphonic with the pronoun they. I don't know whether we're reading too much into it, but Perec himself, when pressed, you know, when he didn't have to wear that mask of silliness, he did mention the fact that yes, it is about my parents.
So how seriously did they take that? This seems to me that when they started and actually throughout the whole movement, which as you say is still ongoing, did they really believe through these constraints you find liberty and therefore sort of a greater truth? Or is it just intellectual game playing?
A lot of it was intellectual game playing, and which is just as well, you know. We don't have to call it escapism.
Yeah.
It's just quite a natural thing for anyone,
for
Homo ludens.
Yeah.
How serious was it? One of the authors featured in this review, Dennis Duncan, when he writes his intellectual history of the phenomenon, he asked this question head on. Is that a mask, or what was the actual mask? Were they just... Because sometimes they look dead serious. Perhaps that was the actual mask. On the other hand, I mean, who cares? We don't really need to appreciate a joke.
Yeah, because there's an argument when sort of modernists, when they have sort of machine learning, and there's this high-minded view that there is a truth that's being reached by automated poetry, for example. Is that what's getting this? But then there's things like this. There's a great example of one of the rules where the S+7 method, where every noun in a text is replaced by the seventh noun further on in a dictionary. I'd love to read that, but presumably it's just nonsense.
Well, I mean, it depends really on the text. So yeah. It's kind of unpredictable. It also depends on what dictionary you pick.
Yeah.
So it could be slightly nonsensical, but I wouldn't necessarily see this rule as the most sophisticated or the most.
But is there a high? I'm guessing is there a belief that by doing this you're getting to a truth that the conscious mind isn't going to get to?
Well, that was one of the kind of lines of thinking, because we must remember that when Ulipo first emerged, there was it's kind of as old as cybernetics, more or less, or let's say cybernetics as a mass phenomenon. I mean, so to me, if I were to try and track the history of this movement, I would look at it as running parallel with the history of computing, because there was some kind of ambiguous relationship between the members of their group, especially back in the 60s, and computers, because they were kind of, they really wanted to get into it, but they were slightly limited, you know, constrained, let's say, in their resources.
Can you go now?
I think
you have to be invited.
Have an annual
you have to be invited specifically. Visitors pass.
Would you like to go?
Sure.
Would it be fun?
Absolutely.
And in the '60s, would it have been fun? Would it have been a bunch of folks showing off, or would it have been people sort of warmly and wittily kind of exploring things?
Yeah, well, I'm sure it's.
I think it's a bit of both. Whether it's people having a lovely convivial time and people taking it deadly serious, it will be a microcosm of.
Is there
of
any
anything.
Chance that anyone from the current Ulipo movement
listens
to the TLS podcast? It's not impossible.
Well, there are 41 members as of 2018.
It feels unlikely, doesn't it?
not all of them are alive. So
How many are alive then?
Couple dozen, I think.
Oh, really?
Okay. So, but we would like an invitation. If one of those 20 odd people is listening to this, there's a constraint if ever there was one.
Absolutely.
We'd go.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
They're there in a jiffy.
Okay. Well, we should do this. Well, I hope we do.
And a school trip coming on.
An Olympian school trip, the mind boggles. Anna, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, thank you.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Toby Lischtig, Anna Aslanian and Madeleine Brettingham. The paper is laden with poetry this week, including two different reappraisals of old John Donne, plus plenty more, including Jonathan Lynn, who we mentioned today, on his experience of directing Kirk Douglas. Get subscribing now. Next week the paper will have a historical bent, and so therefore will we. Until then, from Thea and from me, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.